They're moving in herds. They do move in herds. How'd you do this? I'll show you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja. Once again, I'm Nathan, joined by Nathan, and we're finishing up our third segment on Steven Spielberg. And so joining us again, we have Rachel joining us. Rachel, how are you doing today?
Doing well.
So we are running into last time you were with us, we ended with Hook. Some of you, you know, may or may not have been pleased with the way we rated it and thought of it, but we're running into a new segment of movies here, and we're going to clump these next two together. I'm actually interested in talking about the third one that we have because, to me, it's a fantastic movie. I love that movie. I won't spoil it quite yet. But so we have Jurassic Park and The Lost World. I think by far, just in my opinion, that Jurassic Park was the better of the two movies. Now, I think part of that was the sense of awe and wonder that you got from the movie in that first segment, just going out, seeing the dinosaurs and seeing everything that's being pulled together, where I think in The Lost World, there was some things that just didn't quite work. First of all, we'd seen the dinosaurs before. It didn't make them less impressive, but I don't remember having that pause moment in the movie where it's like, you know, taking my breath away, seeing these things actually coming to life. It was a lot of people running around just being eaten, where at least in the first one, there was some establishing and there was a sense of, wow, this is great. So Nathan, I'm going to go ahead and punch it to you and let you start us off with, your thoughts and go from there.
Okay. So yeah, like we ended last time talking about Hook, and it's interesting because I think I was talking about how I wasn't really like a big fan, but to be fair, and Rachel, who I don't know, we didn't mention at the beginning of this, we mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, is my sister. So we did grow up together and we saw a lot of these movies together. And when I did see Hook, I remember loving it when I was younger. I was a little bit older, but I was in middle school at the time. And I remember seeing Hook and enjoying it and liking it. It really wasn't until later reapproaching it that saying like, okay, this really isn't a good movie. And I think if I saw it as an adult, I wouldn't think it's a good movie. Mm-hmm. But it is probably fair to say I did enjoy it at the time. And there are still things I think are good about it. But Hook also wasn't a big blockbuster for Spielberg. So people who came to it after, I think, you know, it made money, but I don't think it was considered. It was definitely the critics kind of tore him up on it. He didn't win any awards for it. And then, so that's 91, and he had just done Always before, which also was not a hit. So you're kind of getting away from, you're starting to move him away from the Spielberg who is the ironclad, always have a hit kind of guy.
Yeah.
And we had, again, all the producing stuff he had done. And in the 80s, he had done, like, Amazing Stories and things like that. So he had a lot of what he was really well known for. You get to this point now where a lot of that's behind him, in a sense. And so he has this choice. He could keep making movies in this Hook vein or go back and try more of the drama stuff, which he will get to. Mm-hmm. But he goes and he does Jurassic Park off of Crichton's book. Mm-hmm. Jurassic Park was an interesting story, I think, but it wasn't really, it didn't hold together to me at the book as that much. You know, it was an interesting, Crichton was always interesting about making scientific ideas seem plausible, even when we weren't really there yet. You know, in a few years we'll have dinosaurs, you know, probably not, but Crichton makes you believe that we could. In the interesting thing about the book is that in the book, Hammond, John Hammond, is really kind of the bad guy.
Yes.
He is he's a more of a mad scientist type.
Yeah.
And he is actually, I guess spoilers, but he's killed in the book.
Yeah.
I believe actually it's implied that Ian Malcolm dies in the book too, till they realize everyone loved Jeff Goldblum and Crichton found a way to bring him back and just say, oh, we just thought he was dead. But in the book, it was neat because you had all these dinosaurs and then the movie comes out. And I was I was just finishing up middle school when Jurassic Park came to theaters. Mm-hmm. As a kid, I had been a rabid fan of dinosaurs. Like, I was definitely, like, out of my time and place because dinosaurs weren't that popular in the 80s. You know, the only thing Spielberg had his name on involving dinosaurs was The Land Before Time. That's what I had to kind of, like, occupy myself with. I remember there was a movie in the 80s, and people might remember this. The first movie I ever saw in the theater was Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
The second was Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, what a terrible movie. But I actually own it on Blu-ray just because it that nostalgia of going to the theater on my birthday. It was one of the, like, we, in fact, it was so much so that my parents, we never really went to the theater. I mentioned this before.
Well, Jurassic Park holds a special place for me. The very first movie I saw in a theater, because my dad was like, well, you know, all the hype around it because the special effects.
Right.
And Nathan being as into dinosaurs, our house was flooded with dinosaur stuff growing up. And all of a sudden, here it was, dinosaurs brought to screen. And it was such a big thing about the special effects back then. And I remember my dad, like, watching it, and he's being like, this is one I have to take the kids to the theater for. This is the very first movie I saw in the movie theater. So it definitely had, like, I have a big memory surrounding it.
And it's funny that you say that, because you're right in the sense that the last movie I had seen, I'd seen a couple movies with friends, but the last movie I'd seen in the theater with my family before Jurassic Park was Baby, Secret of Lost Legend, like 85. And those were gumpy looking dinosaurs. Yeah. And just about could see the guys in the costume. You know, they didn't move really great. The movie itself was kind of goofy.
Right.
It involves dinosaurs living out in the African Congo, which again is one of those, cryptozoological things that people think is an actual thing, but
right.
Makili Mabembe or whatever. But the movie was not very good. And then we come to Jurassic Park, and when you first see those dinosaurs, and the first time we see the CGI really used, we saw it in Terminator and things like that, and it was impressive, but it was more like, oh, wow, how'd they do that?
Right.
And then, boom, you've got a living dinosaur, in a sense, there in front of you. And, of course, Spielberg's the right guy to capture it, you know, Goldblum kind of chuckling maniacally to himself, seeing the dinosaur Sam Neill almost bowled over to the point where he's on his knees, and like Lardern, and they're standing looking at that Brachiosaur, and it's like a great moment of wonder and a callback to like King Kong and the way they walk past the the Stegosaurus and everything. And then when he looks up and he sees them out there moving in the water, it's just impressive. To be fair, it's mostly a conduit of special effects and editing and things like that. I mean, the magic isn't necessarily thematic there.
Right.
It's just an amazing thing to look at. It's a very cinematic moment.
Yeah.
You're right to say that Lost World has no cinematic moments to me like that of the wonder. They don't really try to capture the dinosaurs in any sort of magnificence anymore. You had the Brachiosaur scenes. Growing up, Triceratops was my favorite dinosaur as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, it's going to be in Jurassic Park. And it's just laying there in the field. But I didn't feel gypped because it's breathing there. The way the chest expanding and rising up, and Neil's like just childlike glee
when
as he's holding.
Puts his head on it.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Have you guys seen the meme going around
with Jeff Goldblum?
Yeah. So someone has taken the shot where Jeff Goldblum is sitting there, kind of smugly, lecherously smiling at the camera, you know, when his shirt is open and he's laying on the like gurney inside the hospital after the dinosaur has like knocked him out, and he's sitting up and his shirt is open, and they've taken Sam Neill, kept him small, and put him there with his head pressed against Goldblum's bare chest with this look of like joy. Somebody on Twitter sent a thing to Sam Neill: have you seen this? He goes, yes, and it's stomach churning.
That movie was the first time Jeff Goldblum left like an impression on me where I actually knew who he was after that, and I did not like him after that movie. He had to redeem himself in other ones, but for some reason as a kid I did not like his character.
I like what people have just edited together scenes of him doing that weird chuckle he does on the plane for like 30 minutes, like well, I liked Goldblum before that in The Fly. Now, you won't like him as a person. I mean, you watch that. It's not going to help your view of him if you associate it with The Fly. But The Fly was a very good movie. And Goldblum is a weird – I like Goldblum because he's such a strange presence. I talked about this. He's the only reason I want to see the second Independence Day.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I like when he shows up in those like – apartment.com commercials. He's just so
I like
weird.
Him now, just as a kid, for whatever reason. That was the first impression I got of him.
But I think he adds a lot of character to Jurassic Park, too. And Spielberg get some. What's nice about Jurassic Park, you didn't really know, your average person didn't know any of those actors walking in that movie.
Yes.
Sam Neill, mm-hmm. Laura Dern. It was an interesting cast to bring together. Richard Attenborough is a great actor and director, but no one had seen much of him up until that point. The guy who plays Muldoon. I mean, all good Richard Peck, but a lot of Bob Peck, a lot of great characters in that movie that come through. Even the kids, I think, were handled okay. They're not too smarmy or anything like that. Mm-hmm. The action scenes, the dinosaur, to this day, that scene with the T-Rex and the Jeep is amazing. Just the way it's shot, the way it's done. Mm-hmm. It's a real thrill ride. I will say this, though. Jurassic Park, to me, while I consider it in the high canon of like the higher end of Spielberg's resume, particularly fantastical films, I love it. It doesn't quite feel as substantial as his other stuff. Like, it is really almost just like a theme park ride, like a roller coaster, like a lot of biting and chomping, and you got to get from point A to point B. I mean, he even lets you go on the roller coaster ride, more or less, literally. Yeah. Like, you ride along and you hear Mr. DNA talking and you go through on the Jeeps. And I like it a lot, but it doesn't have, to me, any kind of thematic resonance. That idea when he talks about the transcending in all his other movies of, like, to something spiritual or to the beyond. Here you basically have man. You've got the simple man playing God.
Right.
Man bringing the wonder to him, and then the wonder getting loose and kind of decimating things. But it doesn't have that same primal kick that Jaws has, I don't think. It's definitely... It's easier to put it more in line with the later disaster movies of people like Roland. It's not fair because it's so much better made than those movies. But I think it's more fitting with those later blockbusters than with Spielberg's earlier blockbusters. Mm-hmm. It's where you start to get to that scorched earth kind of feel.
Sure, sure. And I mean, I will say this about The Lost World is that I do think that they develop Jeff Goldblum's character so he's a more likable character. Mm-hmm. Where in the first one, I think you're right, Rachel. I think, you know, he comes off as an arrogant douchebag. And in some contexts, I really do like that. Like, I think
he does it really well.
Right. Well, but I think even, you know, shows like Hugh Laurie in House. I mean, Hugh Laurie in House comes off as an arrogant douchebag, but he does it in such a way that, like, I can't stop watching it. I'm really enthralled with it. I think Jeff Goldblum's character in Jurassic Park does it in such a way that I just want to slap him.
Yeah.
Where I think The Lost World brings him in and it shows him as a more relatable and likable character. So you can almost excuse how he is in the first one and appreciate the character in both.
And you kind of had to because he was the main star.
Right, right.
You mentioned House. A quick aside, I once had a dentist who was, while he was starting to numb my mouth to actually work on my teeth, says, you know who my hero is? House. And I was like, yeah, check please. And I did not. I never went back to that guy. He was like, can we schedule a thing to do the actual like surgery? He's like, no, we're not scheduling anything. I'm done. But so here's a theory I have about, because Malcolm, I think in the book, wasn't as identifiable as you said as a douchebag. A lot of that's that kind of smarm that Goldblum brings to it.
Like that schmarminess.
Goldblum just smears it all over the movie and that. He's just like sitting there. Even when he's not saying anything, he's just looking like he's
like either the unbuttoned shirt.
Yeah, and, he's like leering at Laura Dern or he's just making snide comments to Attenborough or, you know, glaring at Neil. But in that movie, if you think of a lot of Goldblum's dialogue, it's all very like expositional. This is what the theme of the movie is stuff.
Yeah.
Stuff that is usually actors choke on. Like, he's got to say stuff like, life finds a way, and what you're doing is the rape of the natural world.
Right.
You know? And Gold, if anyone else had done that, it would have slowed the movie to a crawl.
Yes.
Because you just would have an exposition guy coming in to say, the theme of the movie is don't mess with nature. And when Goldblum comes in and adds all that weird – Goldblum's got those weird tics where he moves his hands and he mutters to himself. And you're like, I missed half of what you just said.
Yeah.
Probably what happens here with me on the podcast sometimes. But in the movie, I think he makes that stuff palatable. You don't sit there and think about it because Goldblum's distracting you with his eccentricity.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
The second movie, I liked him in it, but I thought he was less interesting because – they had to make him less eccentric. They had to make him more hero mode. You're right. That movie is just like chomping and eating.
Yeah.
My favorite character was the eccentric character in that movie to me was the little like – there's two. One was the tech guy that comes with him, the bald guy. I can't think of the actor's name. I like him. But he's eaten almost immediately. And I was like, my favorite character's got eaten. The other one is Pete Postlewhite as the great hunter, you know, the kind of Hemingway guy who comes in to hunt the T-Rex.
Yes.
I think he was shortchanged a lot too.
I can't remember the name of the guy, but that when the one character, the first guy that gets eaten, it's funny that one of the tiniest dinosaurs creates such, that frilled, like, pop out at you, like, creates such a scene that stuck with everybody.
Oh, when it eats Newman in Wayne Knight?
Yes.
Yeah. That it was, like, littlest dinosaur. I made, like, one of the biggest impressions of the film.
And they try to do that to a bigger extreme in Lost World by having the compies, which are literally, 2 inches high, and they eat Peter Stormare or something.
Yeah.
But, and then Spielberg tries to lay on this sort of environmental message where, oh, we need to be kind to the dinosaurs.
Right.
It just doesn't really work.
I think something Spielberg does, and with the help of John Williams, is he can create scenes that are that can be defining. Like, they're very whimsical scenes, and like for me, when they first span out, you're talking about that scene. They span out, you see the Brachiosaurus, and it's like, you know, like I don't know, like those scenes were very magical. And again, also my first time in a movie theater, I'm on the edge of my seat, and this whole
thing. Even when the helicopter comes down the valley, like
just island. To me, those were beautiful scenes, like captivating scenes.
I think too in. With Lost World, there were shots where he tries that. It just doesn't quite come out because there's a scene in the Lost World when InGen comes down and they are chasing the dinosaurs. Yeah. And now you have herds of them because on the other island where the dinosaurs have sort of flourished and grown, not Isla Nublar, but was it Isla Sorna? One is Isla Sorna or Isla Nublar. One of the two is the original island. One is the island where the dinosaurs were able to kind of just grow and adapt. And on that island, when they land down with their jeeps, they're chasing these things. And there was an old John Wayne movie called Hatari.
Yes.
That is, like, they deal with African animals. It's a safari. And there's a scene similar to that where Wayne is in the jeep, the open jeep, and he's driving through and you see all the animals. And it's almost identical in some ways what Spielberg's trying to do. And this guy rides a motorcycle underneath, a apatosaurus or something. And the special effects just seem very obvious in that. There was no... That scene, I was like, oh, I recognize the reference. I see the dinosaurs. It didn't stir anything in me. The stegosaurus is walking through are a callback to King Kong, and it just didn't do it. Some of the T-Rex scenes were interesting, but the most impressive scene to me of dinosaurs was at the very end when you see the pteranodon come down and land on the branch and spread its wings with the suggestion that now they're going to be able to fly off the island and cross-pollinate Lord knows what. But to me, that's one of his weakest movies, Lost World, because it feels like a commercial product. I think Ebert said it feels like someone trying to make a Spielberg movie.
Yeah.
There are moments that work, but it's like someone trying to copy his style. Heart doesn't seem to be in it.
Yeah.
Terrible side note, but do you remember Jurassic Park Jawbreakers?
That thing that was like a fistful of sugar.
I don't know why that came back to me.
Because my brother had one and he tried to eat it over the course of a summer. This thing was so rank and nasty.
And he was sitting there licking on it. You're like, oh.
And by the time it was done, he kept it in that little case. So there was like a puddle of like drool slime surrounding this thing. That was terrifying. I was hoping to get to the middle and there'd be like an amber insect in the center of it or something.
Did he ever? I think eventually got trash. I don't know if he ever worked his way through it.
I don't know. I'd like to think he did.
I remember the smell of it.
Okay, let's move on.
Sorry about that.
But I think in the last episode, Rachel, you mentioned how Spielberg did say that after Schindler's List, he had a hard time getting back to working because he was so affected by that experience of making that film. And he did start to pour a lot of his energy into things like the Shoah Foundation and to making awareness for the Holocaust. And I just think when he came back, that Lost World was kind of getting back in the saddle of making an entertainment popcorn movie. And so it took him a little bit. And it wasn't – I mean, it made a lot of money, but again, people I think recognized it wasn't as good as the other one. And then what happens in the meantime of that is Stanley Kubrick, who is another master filmmaker and who kind of came up he was the almost anti-Spielberg in a lot of ways, very cold, antiseptic in some ways, a master too. I think Kubrick is in many ways is a stronger filmmaker than Spielberg, but they're just different, you know, and they're both great in their ways, and we'd be in a very different place if we didn't have both of them. But Kubrick is has been working on years on making a movie called AI, and he's basing it off a short story by a sci-fi author named Brian Aldiss, who wrote a story called Super Toys last all summer long. And I can't remember the relationship, whether Aldiss wrote it with Kubrick in mind, because, you know, that's a weird thing. When 2001 came out, we all assumed that 2001, it's based off a short story, but the 2001 novel is sort of written more in conjunction with the making of the movie. So there's a relationship there. So, but either way, Kubrick's been trying to get it off the ground. Then what happens is when it finally starts to manifest and come together, this passion project he had, Kubrick dies.
Yes.
And it gets passed on to Steven Spielberg. And it's been, apparently it's been done with the blessing that Kubrick wanted Spielberg to work on this and to, he felt that he could do it justice. And so now Spielberg is picking up a project began by Stanley Kubrick. For film fans, this is a huge thing because you've got one artist who's very different than the other, but both are very well esteemed and liked, making this science fiction movie, a supposedly hard science fiction movie.
Yeah.
And it, you know, AI, artificial intelligence, sci-fi is just starting to kind of – is now on the upswing again, finally kind of coming back into – its own, if you will. And so we have AI, and it comes out in the summer of 2001.
Yep.
I was so, so excited for it. I saw the movie. I remember being at the Senator Theater here in Baltimore, going to see it with a couple of friends. And again, anticipation being really high. This was one of the first movies, too, they started to do some of that viral marketing for, with a lot of the kind of stuff that Abrams does now, where you'd follow this, you could call a phone number and hear this weird voice talk about how the Meccas were revolting and stuff, and weird mystery stories.
Yeah.
It was interesting, and I was a huge fan of Blade Runner by that point, and I was like, okay, this looks like something that's going to explore the similar world that was set up in Blade Runner. And I went to see the movie, and I remember watching it and coming out, and then the initial thought after I'd just seen it, being like, oh man, it wasn't really what I was expecting. It's kind of a mixed bag. That wasn't the masterpiece I wanted. I don't know who's – was that Spielberg or Kubrick that made that choice or that choice? Wasn't sure. Felt like a weird stitched-together thing, if you will. But then even that night, like I was back in college where I could stay up to 2 or 3 and, you know,
right.
spend time at Denny's contemplating movies and whatnot.
Right.
But by the end of the night, I was like, wow, there's a lot of stuff that's sticking with me. And it's funny because, Rachel, you think you just saw the movie, the whole thing, for the first time a few nights ago.
I remember when it came out, I remember that I, when I watched the preview on, you know, whenever, I thought it looked really cool. At some point before, like between seeing the preview and then the movie actually coming out, I got like, whether it was the age I was in, you know, high school, getting my driver's license, all that, whatever. I don't know. I became disenchanted with it, never saw it. But when I rewatched it, well, when I watched it for the first time the whole way through, I had a little bit of that. Like when I first got done, I'm like, it had Spielberg all over it to me. And for that, there was like, definitely a response of I really like this, but I don't know if I do really like this. And then, but then after I thought about it for about 24 hours, I really liked it. But I also like sci-fi movies. Like in very vague ways, harkens back to like Fifth Element and stuff like that for me. Movies which I really like, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nathan?
Yeah. I remember, going and seeing it in theaters, again, 2001. I think I was just about to – it was spring of 2001 that it came out, correct?
It was in June. We'll see – let's see how my amazing movie identifying ability
– That's right.
The other day I was able to identify some movies right on the date. I'm going to say June 18th of 2001.
Okay, that sounds right because I would have been – I would have just been about to enter my freshman year of college that year. So I remember I think I saw the preview for it and I was with a couple of friends and I was like, hey, let's go check this out. Steven Spielberg. I think it's going to be pretty decent. Go ahead, Nathan. You found it?
June 29th, 2001.
Nice.
So it was only 10 days off.
So saw it and I loved it. And what's funny is I'm not a big Pinocchio fan. To me, Pinocchio is – I can't stand that Disney movie at all.
Oh, man.
I can't – I don't know what it is, but I just cannot stand that movie.
Creepy little wooden boy.
Sorry, Jiminy Cricket.
But I love this movie. I love this telling of the Pinocchio
like the children getting turned into asses?
Well, you know. Yeah, again, I don't know what it is. I just – it doesn't work for me, but this did. And I love that combination. I think, we had just seen Haley Joel Osment, coming off of, Sixth Sense, fantastic little actor. And he wasn't a one hit wonder. He managed to jump into this and do a really
like a
good
hit
job.
Wonder.
Well, he did do Secondhand Lines as well, though.
Yeah. I like Secondhand Lines.
So, to me, this was just a great job. You have Jude Law, who had done – we talked about Gattaca a few years earlier. So now he's – it would have been, what, 4 years earlier that he had done Gattaca?
Yeah, the movie he had just come off of when he does AI was Enemy at the Gates.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, jumping into another very kind of different role for him, he plays this upstart, pompous ass in
Is that really
Gattaca.
A different role for Jude Law? Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, then he plays this compelling sniper in Enemy at the Gates, which was a good movie. I enjoyed that one. Now he's coming into this very – I mean, it's
– He's a pompous robotic ass. Well,
but it works for him because that's how he's programmed to be. He's programmed
Gigolo
to
Joe.
Be. Yeah, exactly. So it works for him. And to me, this movie just brought together so many different elements. You know, you see – New York just totally underwater, completely mm-hmm. flooded over.
Just the tops of the highest buildings sticking out of the ocean.
Yeah, and so seeing
the trade
that
towers were in it.
Yeah, exactly. Because it
this and Final Fantasy: Spirits Within came out the same summer, like within a few weeks. They were some of the last movies that the trade towers visually seen mm-hmm. in a sci-fi movie. Yeah. The idea that they'd still be there in the future is right the summer before.
Yeah, and so going back and seeing any movie like that that has the trade towers in it, it's haunting, you know. And so seeing it at the time, just the anticipation of what's going on in the future, and you know, the world has global warming's happened, it's flooded the earth, and AI is becoming now a viable option for many different things. And so that story, that adventure, and really what you find out is the character's being taken on an adventure that he didn't know about and that mm-hmm. you don't find out about until later on. You find out that this character is being watched as he's going on his journey, and you don't even find that out until later, which I thought was an interesting kind of little twist that was happening. And so I don't know. I remember coming out of it. Now the friends I was with just weren't impressed with it. They didn't like it.
The
whole fairy tale thing.
Yeah.
But I do remember just really enjoying that movie. I own that movie, love it. I will go back and watch it. Joy's not a fan of the movie. I don't know what it is about it that she doesn't really like, but, it seems to be a movie that's pretty, you know, polarizing with people. Rachel?
I think touching back when you're talking about the actors, what I like with Jude Law is he's not just this pompous gigolo character. He's got a compassionate side. Like mm-hmm. sometimes when you see these pompous characters, the selfish jerk is just all about themselves. But he actually comes alongside David and is kind of wanting to help him out. I mean, at first he's like, score is my golden ticket. You know, I got caught on this guy's sales. But then he's like actually wanting to go on his journey with him. And Haley Joel Osment, I think, does a fantastic job of both being a little boy mm-hmm. and being a robot. When he has that like stare where he just stares off and he says something that's just not quite fitting. Like mm-hmm. it's not a human thing to say.
Right.
For the age that I don't know how old he was at that time, at least he looks like a young 10-year-old boy. I thought he did a fantastic job of creating that distinction in his portrayal. And I love the Pinocchio element, the kind of traipsing along that fairy tale line. I really enjoyed that.
You know, with the Disney movies that are coming out, these live action Disney movies that are being brought out, and you know, with the Jungle Book, that fantastic job done with the Jungle Book. Nate, you said you saw Cinderella, which you enjoyed.
I did. I liked it.
And we have Beauty and the Beast coming out. So to me, this is a retelling of the Disney story in a real life way that's unique. It doesn't follow the script per se, but it's different enough and unique enough that it worked for me. And like I said, I don't like Pinocchio. I don't like that Disney movie, but I did enjoy this, and I enjoyed this retelling of that story.
Yeah, and you know, there's actually a lot I want to say about this movie, because I'll be honest, after seeing it and then seeing it and be, hey, this is a really good movie, I honestly, over time and over the years, have come to think that this is one of Spielberg's best movies. I'd actually be willing to say that even though there are some flaws in it, that this is one of his masterpieces. I would put it in the top five. That's probably not – I'm actually happy that all three of us like it, because to me, it seems hard to get three people in the room that do like this movie because people had a lot of – like, it just wasn't what they were expecting from Spielberg. It didn't harken back at all in any way to that working class hero, warm, cozy feel Spielberg. And in some ways, some of what Spielberg is doing, I think, is playing off of his weaknesses. But people just saw it as his weaknesses in this movie. And I want to like set up a little bit of that, but I will say that with artificial intelligence, with this particular film, I think you do see the melding of the Spielberg and the Kubrick, and you mentioned using the Pinocchio story as a baseline. He does make a new fable out of Pinocchio. I feel like he wanted to tell the sci-fi or fantastical version of Peter Pan when he did Hook. Mm. And I don't think he was successful there because he never quite got beyond the fairy tale trappings. Mm. I feel like AI is a successful science fiction telling of Pinocchio.
Yeah.
And I really love, I do love the Disney Pinocchio. It is a favorite of mine. It is a very weird and dark story. It's strange. It's hard to really understand what the heck's going on with it. So I like that he's taken it and made it into something totally new and different. Let's talk a little bit about the fact of the setup of the story, which involves the mechas and the orgas, which is artificial intelligence has gotten to a point where it's essentially become human surrogate.
Yeah.
The same kind of thing in some ways that happened in Blade Runner, although I think that Spielberg and Kubrick were trying to explore it in a more kind of realistic setting, in the sense that we aren't so far down the pipe that in Blade Runner, the replicants have been around for quite a while, and they have just become slaves, essentially. That's not quite here. These are still robots, but we are just getting to a point where they are feigning human emotions but don't have emotions of their own. It's implied in Blade Runner that the replicants had emotions, right, and that somehow we just got into a place where we have androids with emotions and that they had these built-in memories to help them control the emotions. So they're almost like functioning people already. In AI, they are not. Yeah. We see varying stages of the robots, and we have seen that society has both embraced them in some areas and has rejected them to the point that you have groups and vigilante groups, flesh fairs they call, that go and round up any generation yeah, robots and destroy them because they see them as this abomination. They sort of cite, I don't know if they cite a spiritual stance, but I think they kind of do that. Okay, these are created in man's image by man, and they should be destroyed. They're an abomination. And so you have those weird scenes of the flesh fairs gathering people up, and you have even that other element. The movie breaks down into three pieces, much like 2001, where maybe even four pieces, because you've got the first one, which is David, who is the little boy android who comes from Professor Hobie, who is William Hurt, and he brings him in and he gives him to this family whose son is in a coma, and he is supposed to be their surrogate child, and it's just not working because he looks like a little boy, but he's completely cold and completely emotionless, the very thing that the mother wants him to be there for, which is kind of a selfish thing. I mean, I'm not saying it's not an understandable thing, but it's a selfish thing. She wants a feeling, emotional center that she can kind of gravitate towards, because her son, she can't. He's sitting there and he is comatose. And this is a little creepy robot boy that doesn't, he only reminds her of her son in bad ways, meaning she looks at him and sees a little boy, but she goes to talk to him. He's just cold and robotic.
Right.
And like Rachel said, there's a good distinction of them being a cold, robotic alien element. Lots of times when actors try to play, even young characters try to play robots, I'm thinking Vicky of Small Wonder.
I was just thinking of Vicky talking in the monotone. Like.
Right. That I talked about this too, and there's a movie, Ex Machina, where Alicia Vikander played an artificial intelligence character. And usually what people do is they just drain their voice of emotion, and that's a robot. But Vikander and also Osment try to get an idea of an alien, an entity that doesn't think like we do at all.
Right.
Not even that it thinks differently, but it thinks in a completely different systematic way, and it makes different choices, and it isn't really good at making a complete camouflage of the fact that it doesn't understand.
Right.
But when she flips the switch, she's basically told, you can do this, but he will imprint on you, and he's not going to be able to unimprint.
Yeah.
And she makes that selfish choice to have him imprint on her and become like her son. And things are good for like 5 minutes before they realize all the little problems that having this little robot boy around, that in fact he isn't a person.
Right.
But now he has this one – he now too has an own selfish motivation, which is to love.
Right.
He wants to love. It's a very much an action for him. His goal and mission is to love his mother. And he tries to – and when the other boy wakes back up, there's now –
yeah,
a disconnect because his mission is thwarted constantly.
Right.
I thought that was in some ways the most interesting segment of the movie that culminates with her leaving him in the woods because they don't know how to deal with him anymore. Right. And
well, the option is that if you remember, she's got to take him back and they're essentially going to destroy him.
Right. So she leaves him in the woods in this kind of understated but heartbreaking scene where she tells him, "I'm sorry I never told you about the world." and leaves him out there, which sets him
very quickly in 3 minutes, yeah. tries to tell him, stay away from people, stay away from flesh fares. I'm sorry I didn't tell you about the world. Takes off, and you're like, oh, my goodness.
And you start to introduce Gigolo Joe, who yeah. is the he's basically like the pleasure model robot or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that's what he is. He's a sex worker. The male version, we see he meets Gigolo Jane as yeah. he's walking past yeah. her. And, of course, I think what happens is he goes into one of his clients, and her husband has murdered her. Mm-hmm. And now he's on his run. He's on the run, and he has to cut out his, like –
tracking
tag, and he and David run afoul of the flesh fairs. What did you guys think about the flesh fair scenes?
You talked about, you know, you weren't quite sure if, you know, the flesh fairs were getting into something, you know, deeper, more spiritual. I think they were, and part of what you see is in that scene, you know, David is brought in, and the ringleader of this is putting him up ready to destroy him. And, you know, the people don't want him to do that. They don't want him to destroy this what they are perceiving as a little boy, even though he's brought him out and confirmed, no, this is a robot. This is what they're trying to do to us. They're trying to, you know, even make little children into these things. And, you know, the crowd is turning against him, and he kind of cracks this smile and says, he who is without sim, S-I-M, cast the first stone. You know, so they're playing on some of those biblical allusions.
Is that what he says?
Yes.
I never noted that before.
Yeah.
That's a good call.
And, and so, you know, well, interestingly enough, the people turn against him because what they're still seeing is this little boy and a frightened little boy. And to me, that's the brilliance of Haley Joel Osment as a young actor, was he was able to portray so many different things and bring out that emotion, you know, that sense of he's terrified, you know, he's terrified that he's about to die. And even though he's a robot, he is self-aware, and those things are coming out. And so, you know, the crowd turns against him, and, you know, he and Joe are able to escape that. Rachel, what were your thoughts?
I felt like there's like different angles to the flesh fair thing. Cause at first, when you're first introduced to it, it's kind of horrific. Because you've got like these almost like bloodthirsty humans. They're at this rally and they're all raging. They're like, kill it, destroy it. And the things that they're doing, these robots, even though you have, because there's this whole, for me, struggle in my mind between they're robots, but they're very human, you know, and the things that they're doing to them are horrible. Like the acid, dropping acid on them. And one of them, you know, the one robot they're taking out, and he's like, I'm a 75-year-old model. He's like kind of explaining himself, and they're like, shut up, we're going to kill you anyways. And the one is like a nanny bot or something. And there's like this super sweet character. And then you just see her get doused with acid.
It's like the Roman Colosseum.
Yeah, you're like, this is horrific. And so to me, the spiritual element there is, sorry to say, is like that overhyped religion, where religion turns hatred, you know, mm-hmm. and there, and the, you know, I think at some point he says something, the ringleader guy says something about it being sacrilegious because they're, or disgracing the sacredness of childhood mm-hmm. when he sees David. So that they're all there because they hate that these robots are trying to take over, and kind of disgrace humanity with these robots. But they're taking it to the point where they're destroying them or hatred. I'm like, how could you look at something that's like smiling, like the nanny bot, and laugh when it's getting doused with acid? So there's that horrific element that twinges a little, for me, a little too much with the reality of that angle of society, which puts me way off. But then when he puts David up there and David screams for his life, and the woman says, wait a minute. Like, mechas don't scream for their life. This is a little boy. What are you doing? And you see that turn. So then there's that second element, the second angle where almost like their humanity comes back a little bit because they see this little boy and they're like, absolutely not. And we are not going to destroy this little boy. So,
you know, that scene you just mentioned is probably like one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And I think you nailed all of the elements that I like about it, and it's something that's resonated with me over the years. And you're right. What we're seeing is a very specific hatred. It is fueled by an ideology, but it is not even necessarily reflective of that ideology well thought out. You know, this idea that they're going to take over. And I believe Gigolo Joe even tells David, they fear us because we will be here after they are. There's a legitimate fear that they're going to supersede us or take away from us. And you get into an element that this is relatable to the way we see some groups express hate or focus hate towards, whether it's homosexuals or in the past with racism. These things are always excused by some ideology, even mm-hmm. though the heart of where it comes from doesn't really extol that hate.
Right.
It usually rebuffs it, but they adopt it anyway. And when in AI, what is interesting, and I think this is a good takeaway, is when they're confronted with David, they see him and they're like, well, that can't be a Mecca, but he is a Mecca. And they are confronted with compassion because they have to, they see him in front of them and they have to take him for what he is. They are forced into compassion. They've spent so much time distancing themselves so they don't feel compassion. And I think that's something that people should think about.
Yeah.
I mean, that we should think about when we hide, when we extol any kind of idea or belief without tying it to our humanity, it becomes dangerous. That's yeah. any belief and idea. I think even our faith is still tied to us being human. You know, we right. can't relate to things otherwise. And when you are just hiding behind an idea and you divorce it from where it came from and you start using it as a reason to peddle hate,
yeah,
it's time to re-examine things because you're part mm-hmm. of the flesh fair, I'm sorry to say.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the ending of AI. We could probably do an entire podcast on it.
Yeah.
The Rouge City scene where he goes and visits Dr. No and he yeah. starts to find out where the Blue Fairy might be. I like it, but I was a little disappointed because I wanted those scenes to be more visually impressive. I like where they go across the bridge, but when they get to Rouge City, it just looks like a amped up Las Vegas kind of.
Sure.
And Dr. No doesn't turn out to be some interesting, like Rachel, you had said, I was kind of thinking he might be an older model robot or something. Mm-hmm. And instead yeah. he turns out to be kind of like an animated cartoon Einstein with the voice yeah. of Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And it didn't really work for me. I didn't think it was terrible, but it kind of was anticlimactic. I do like the scene where he goes back and meets Professor Hobie and he realizes yes. that he has been drawing him to him
yes.
and that David is based off his own son who died. So it is, again, we see the selfishness aspect or the self-involved aspect of human beings that he's created David in the image of his son.
Yeah.
And the entire line of robots is really a way for him dealing with his own personal grief.
Yeah.
And when I was in the theater, you talked about how you guys had responses to it, like your friends had a different response. I was the same way. I remember watching the movie, and then David is trapped at the bottom of the ocean at this point, looking at the Blue Fairy. He's trapped in the Ferris wheel, and then it cuts to black, and I was like, oh, that was cold as ice, Spielberg. The movie's over. I can't believe you did it. And I was like, amazing. And I'm just about to get up and walk out, and then suddenly the tagline 2,000 years later pops yes. up, and my friend lets out the most depressing, pitiful sigh I've ever heard from a human being. It was like, like, oh no, there's more. And the movie continues for another 20-some minutes.
Yeah.
What did you – Rachel and I talked a little bit about it. Nathan, what did you think about that ending?
I liked it because to me this is David's quest. David's on a journey. You know, from the moment his mother activates him, his quest, his goal, his purpose is to love her. Mm-hmm. And that he will do that because he's a robot until his dying day because he is imprinted on her. And we know as a robot he will never die unless, you know, he's melted by acid. but to me, this really brought about an interesting resolution because we have these aliens coming in at the end who are trying to understand all they can about humans.
So Nathan, here's a question, because Rachel and I talked about that.
Yeah.
And this has been something I always meet people and it goes back and forth. Are they aliens?
I mean, my thought is yes, they are, because I see what you're saying, because there's no human left, and so...
Well, what I mean is right. When they encounter these characters, which do very much resemble Spielberg's Close Encounter aliens,
yeah.
with a few differences, which are worth mentioning, which is they have these weird, like, electric-looking lights. So they're yeah. clearly... We've had Mecha and Orga the whole movie, but these seem to be a mix of both.
Yeah.
But they don't look like people at all. They're just, right. like, shimmery, almost... Again, we have that transcendent element of they've yeah. almost transcended a normal human body. But they talk about David and Teddy, which is a character we haven't mentioned, a character I love, right. the little teddy bear,
yes. yeah,
who's both creepy and adorable at the same time. And he and David are the ones left, and he says, these are versions or these are ones that knew human beings. And it sounds to me almost as if a human being had dug up a Neanderthal and said, this is our descendant. I believe that they're not aliens. They are the advanced mechas that far in the future, Gigolo Joe says, that we will be what's left. We will be what remains. And through the movie, David is the first emoting robot. He gets pulled out of the timeline because he ends up trapped under the Ferris wheel. He has no more interaction. But even Gigolo Joe, Rachel, you talked about how he becomes kind. Kind should never be a part of who Gigolo Joe is because he's a robot with programming. But when he meets David, it seems like David, who the thing that makes him different is he has a hope. He wants to achieve something. He believes in the Blue Fairy. He wants to get there. And I think he changes Gigolo Joe. Gigolo Joe makes a statement at the end. And remember, I am, I was. He becomes aware of himself as a person. And I feel like David sets off this almost infectious thing that sends the robots on a developmental path that ends with these things that we see. So that's kind of my take. I always thought that they were advanced robots.
My take was that they were advanced robots. That was my take when I watched it. And one of there was a line from Joe that's like a little bit, you know, speaking to the film when Joe looks at him and he says, human beings are always thinking about, you know, their creator. Human beings are always so obsessed with the existential. And that's what separates us. That's what most separates us from humans is that we can't believe in that stuff. And he's talking to David, who's on a quest for the Blue Fairy. You know, so he's saying, so he's trying to tell David, we as robots, we don't believe in things. And David's believing in something. You know, that's not logical or realistic. And so that kind of crossed my mind. And then when they show up at the end, my interpretation was that was kind of speaking to the advancement of where the robots were going, perhaps.
Interesting. I honestly, I'd never thought about that before, that perspective. I'll have to go back and watch that with that thought in mind.
I think the other thing that to me made me think that was when they meet David, when they find him, he's in the ice and the Blue Fairy kind of shatters the statue of the Blue Fairy and they're left there. They start talking to him and kind of figuring out who he is and they start tapping each other's head. It's like file sharing. Mm-hmm. They are like sharing a file between them. And I'm like, okay, so there's I think Spielberg makes clear that even if they're aliens, there's definitely a created sense to them. So I'm like, well, who created them? And I feel like in the context of the AI story, it makes most sense to say, they are the advanced mechas. And I think what that also informs a little bit of what happens next. Nathan, did you want to kind of talk about how you felt about that?
Yeah, I mean, because the idea is, again, they want David's experience. They want his knowledge. But looking at it, they also see something that's very unique in him, that he is – I think they use the words one of a kind. And so in that, they want to do whatever they can for him. And his goal, his desire is to be with his mother. They want them to bring her back. And what's interesting is they make it very clear that, you know, humans are complex, you know, which I think is interesting because we're, you know, around 2001, we're in a time where, again, you have this idea that, well, we're just a random jumble of molecules and, you know, evolution kind of threw us together. But these aliens seem to touch on something that there's a complexity to not being able to replicate or replicate long human cloning, essentially. And I think the idea is like they can bring someone back, but it's for a period of 24 hours and that's it.
And after that, they will no longer temporally exist. You'll never be able – and in a sense, they aren't existing anymore. I don't know if that's the robots understand enough of the concept of the soul to say that she's basically would be evaporated from the system. But she will at least be locked out from them forever. They will never be able to access it again.
Yeah. So, you know, they grant David his wish, you know, bringing her back, and you have that scene, the final closing scene, you know, to your point, Nathan, where, you know, the screen goes black and you're ready to walk out. You know, now we actually have the final closing scene where he spends the day with his mother, and you see at the end, you know, he is cuddling with her in her arms, and then it fades out. So you have that idea of, you know, whatever else, David is finally complete. his mission is finally complete, if in the fact that he has achieved seeing his mother one last time and being able to be with her and love her. And even though it is only for a day, he seems to on some level know and understand that and be okay with that. And I think as an audience, at least from my end, I was left feeling okay with that, that yeah, his mother's no longer there, but he is still there existing and that's okay.
Well, he gets what he finally wants, which is right. to hear her say she loves him.
Yeah.
You know?
So interesting thing with that ending, and particularly in light of if, you know, I guess it doesn't matter as much, but if they are robots, then there is a sense to go back to what Rachel said about how Joe mentions we aren't looking for our creator, and we see David looking to the blue fairy. But now these robots have been scouring and seemingly looking for David. They don't seem to find him by accident.
Yeah.
They've tracked him down. They know where he is and they get him. And it seems to be why he's valuable to them. It's not simply that he's one of a kind. They tell him that. They kind of give him the spiel. You're special. But I think he's valuable to them because he is a reflection or a artifact that points them to their creator.
I think they call him an archive.
Yeah.
Their last archive yeah. of human memory.
And so humans aren't just – if they're aliens, then the humans are just this species that were on Earth that they want to know about, mm-hmm. an extinct species. But if they are robots, they're tied to the creator. Mm-hmm. That is their link to their own creator. And so it is proved out that what Joe didn't think would happen has happened, which is yeah. that the robots do think and do long for the creator. So they find – David. And so if through that lens, though, it makes me wonder about their motives, because they tell David, we're going to give you your mother back. Mm-hmm. And they tell him he won't really understand. He's still kind of like a child. They provide her to him, but they give him the choice. They don't just say, you're going to get your mother. They say, right. if we do this, you will never have her again. You'll have her for one day. And they even talk about it in a contextual way to say, she will basically be locked out of the universe access. You'll never be able to have her again. In a way, you'll be destroying her, kind of like her right. her sense of self will be completely gone. It won't be there anymore. But you can have her for one day. Make the choice. And he's maybe making it sort of a child, but he makes the choice to have her for one day. And in almost in that way, he defines his humanity by being selfish. Yeah. In a way, the most human thing David does through all the movie is make the selfish choice to have his mother, as opposed to not have her, but she maybe retains some sense. And I wonder then if that's actually true, meaning are the robots really only capable of bringing her back for one day and then she'll be lost to the universe forever? That seems like a weird thing.
Right.
Or are they aware enough of human traits that they're testing human traits? And David, in a sense, is sort of in this lab bubble. Maybe it's not the most cozy ending mm-hmm. or reading of the ending, but it seems to me that they're testing him, they're observing him, and that the choice they give him is not just a reward, like, David, you're so wonderful and unique, you get a prize. Mm-hmm. But really, this is all part of a conditioned testing to see what human beings would really do, because David's been made in the image of human beings. Mm-hmm. So they want to see, what would a human being do? And he makes that choice. So it's a weird, there is a dark undercurrent, I think, that when she goes to sleep, he's comforted, but she's gone. She's locked out from, in his love and desire for this one thing, he's destroyed it, in an essence. Or he has at least made it so he can never, it's irrevocably away from him. He can never get it back. And so at the end, it says he went to the place of dreams. I'm not even quite sure what that means or what happens. Yeah.
That left me with like a lot of questions and wondering, because, you know, in the movie, he can't sleep and he can't die. And then at the end, he closes his eyes and says, for the first time, David goes to that place where dreams are created. And you're like, what does that mean?
I almost wondered if it didn't mean that he, in some capacity, dies in the sense that a robot can. That is, essentially, he's achieved a place where the robots are going to shut him down. He's now in the archives. He's still around. He's physically there, but maybe he's in a place of oblivion too. I don't know.
Yeah. There's so many things that, you know, to discuss in this movie, and, you know, so many things that we didn't even hit on. But we are rapidly running out of time, and so we do want to kind of wrap up this segment and, you know, just kind of make some announcements, because we do want to go ahead, Nathan. I'll let you.
Yeah, we thought this was going to be three. We really did, but it looks like it's going to be four, which we're okay with, because it was probably going to be four anyway, because we really wanted to provide a review where the three of us could get back together and discuss the BFG to kind of close out this series. So what we're actually going to do, because we spent so much time with AI, next podcast, or the next part of this podcast, this series, we're going to discuss Minority Report, mm-hmm. War of the Worlds, Tintin, and then what we'll do is go in and probably do about a half hour discussing BFG, because we're all going to see it next week together. Mm-hmm. So yep. Looking forward to that. Had a great time with this. It's really fun to be able to go back and go through Spielberg's catalog. Yeah. I really want to just go home and watch AI right now. And so great time, guys. I had a wonderful
Thanks
time
for inviting me along.
Absolutely. Looking forward to the next time. We'll catch y'all later.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?